Again, we're going to be talking now more about that selfsame Errands to Rome, one of the most interesting, one certainly can't say tragic because the man was a monster, one of the most ironic, I suppose, of the lives of the founders of the Germany that that we all know as Nazi Germany. Errands to Rome, a man who, as Dave was talking about earlier, although himself a brutal street thug and a brawler, and basically in almost all ways the perfect Nazi type, was himself a very straightforward, one might even say a bold homosexual, and had a cult of homosexuality.
Exactly.
In the
SA. Literally, he was a doctrinaire homosexual, and in fact, you'll see echoes of that in a couple of the passages we're going to read. He basically felt that men who had sex with women were sissies, and that real powerful warriors had sex with other men.
Okay, continuing from the Pink Triangle and reading about Ernst Röhm. By the way, for those of you not familiar, Röhm is spelled R-O-E-H-M. Röhm was made chief of the SA, and went on to preside over its expansion. By the way, the SA was the initial group made up originally of largely street thugs, brawlers, people who would go out in the street with sticks and bottles and guns and knives and attack the communist demonstrators and the union demonstrators and things, and it only became an official organ later on, and began to become uniformed later on. And so Röhm rose to the top by being one of the best of the brawlers. Röhm was made chief of the SA and went on to preside over its expansion, recruiting thousands of adoring, unsophisticated young men. He kept their loyalty until the end. According to his recollections, and even his most venomous enemies within the Nazi Party never disputed this, he never began a sexual relationship with anyone under his command. Indeed, Röhm was 37 years old when he had sex with another man for the first time. It must have taken a certain amount of bravado for Röhm to conduct his affairs as casually as he did. Whether this was a sign of indifference and courage, or just plain foolhardiness, is hard to know. What is certain is that such unabashed behavior earned him the unending hatred of Himmler and Heydrich, both still nominally under Röhm's command. For about 1 year, Hitler kept faith with his second-in-command. When complaints about the blatantly open homosexual behavior of Röhm and his henchmen continued to reach him, Hitler issued an official statement. Quote, "Some people expect SA commanders to take decisions on these matters which belong purely to the private domain. I reject this presumption categorically. The SA is not an institute for the moral education of genteel young ladies, but a formation of seasoned fighters. The sole purpose of any inquiry must be to ascertain whether or not the SA officer is performing his official duties. His private life cannot be an object of scrutiny unless it conflicts with basic principles of National Socialist ideology." Grateful for Hitler's support, Röhm responded by issuing an order of the day that flaunted his homosexuality and widened the gap between himself and his enemies. Quote, "I take advantage of the prevalence of these excrescences of prudishness to make it clear that the German Revolution has been won not by Philistines, bigots, and sermonizers, but by revolutionary fighters. It is the SA's task not to keep watch on the attire, complexion, and chastity of others, but to haul Germany to its feet by dint of their free and revolutionary fighting spirit. I therefore forbid all officers and men of the SA and SS to employ their activities in this field and allow themselves to become the stooges of perverse moral aesthetes." Röhm's bold declaration must have infuriated Himmler, whose loathing of homosexuals knew no bounds. But he could not act against Röhm without Hitler's permission, and that permission would not be forthcoming until the Führer was persuaded that Röhm was no longer needed. And until his 1933 takeover, Hitler had little choice but to rely upon his SA captain. Röhm's stormtroopers had provided a spigot of terror that Hitler had turned on and off as the occasion demanded. The SA had cleared a path to power. By the end of 1933, Hitler had succeeded brilliantly. Most important government jobs had been filled by Nazi Party members. The expulsion of non-Nazis from key positions in the judiciary, the civil service, and various bureaucracies proceeded without complication. Neither left-wing, moderate, nor conservative groups offered significant resistance. Hitler had swept everything before him. Yet, some internal problems persisted. Among them, in 1934, was one that Hitler did not wish to face: what to do with Rome and his brown shirts now that they were no longer needed.
And indeed, the again, continuing with the background to the Rome Purge. Again, as we're going to see in the passages that we're reading on this, the real reason for Ernst Röhm's elimination, by the way, the Ernst Röhm, his relationship to the SA, is described in considerable detail, again, in the two-part Hard Rain series that's available from archives on audio, basically dealing with the Freikorps and the origins of the Nazi Party. So that's, if you want to find out about Ernst Röhm in detail, that's a good source to go to from our archives. But the real reason, of course, is that Ernst Röhm believed that his SA, which grew directly out of the Freikorps and the Black Reichswehr, the Sturmabteilung, that the storm troops, the brown shirts who paved Hitler's rise to power in part through suppressing his political enemies, part of Ernst Röhm's program was to have them replace the regular German army. Hitler, being a savvy individual, realized that his plan for world conquest could only be furthered by this army. So basically a rivalry between Rome and the army was the real reason, but his homosexuality was used here as a very important device to help justify getting rid of him. And again, we're looking at this as against the background of anti-vice, political assassination as anti-vice action, as we looked at before. That's going to be the theme of the next several items that we're going to be looking at. To put it plainly, in 1934, this swashbuckling mercenary, father and drill master to his troops, straightforward and tactless, simply did not grasp Germany's political reality. Quick on the battlefield but slow in politics, Rome never understood Hitler's renunciation of insurrection in favor of a strategy of legality to consolidate his power. Circuitous tactics in the military or political arena were beyond Rome's imagination. Rome was never able to understand why Hitler, now that he was chancellor, seemed so solicitous, even generous, toward the army and the Ancien Régime. For Rome, unlike Hitler, had never learned the lesson of the failed putsch of 1923. If Nazi victory was to be achieved, it would be necessary to win the army's support or at least its acquiescence. Hitler's embrace of the tactics of apparent accommodation, even compromise with the old order, seemed to Rome to be a betrayal of the original ideals of the Nazi revolution. But it was precisely these tactics that Hitler had to use to outmaneuver the barons of industry and the patricians of the army. Hitler had been elected chancellor by the slimmest of margins. Now he had to reassure the industrialists and army aristocrats that he could be trusted to pursue a course of moderation and to expel the extremists within his own party. But Rome kept trying to push his pet scheme. The SA must incorporate the regular army into one powerful, unified force under his command. It was, he felt, the only sure means of guaranteeing the purity of the Nazi revolution. At first, the military had welcomed Rome, since the SA had militarized thousands of men who, because of the 1918 treaties, could not join the regular ranks. But the high command had never countenanced the possibility that a coarse, homosexual Bavarian provincial should actually run the armed forces. General Walter von Brauchitsch, one of Rome's more outspoken critics, remarked, quote, "Rearmament is too serious and militarily important to be left to hoodlums and homosexuals like Captain Rome." But as the SA grew, Brauchitsch and other leading officers began to fear that the army might well be replaced. To General Werner von Fritsch, commander of the regular army, it was unthinkable that the ragged upstarts of the SA could be anything but subordinate to the professional military men of the Reichswehr. It is one of the many ironies to be found in the Third Reich's history that von Fritsch, who conspired to smash the SA and propel Himmler's SS into power, would 4 years later fall victim to an SS plot in which the general's alleged homosexuality would topple him from power.
We should, although we'll mention it more later on, we should mention that Rome's defeat was not, although mostly due to, as Dave mentioned, to the his unfortunate position vis-a-vis the army, but also because of the enmity earned by him on the part of Heinrich Himmler, and we'll be talking about him later. But Himmler and homosexuality were a pair that did not mix well.
Yeah, planned, in fact, dwells at great length on Himmler, his personality, background, and career, because Himmler was the real linchpin of official anti-homosexual activity in Germany.
Himmler considered himself to be a great eugenicist. Unfortunately, forced to hew to political duties, but his great love was chicken farming, and he really envisioned himself as being somebody who understood racialism and destiny. And nowhere in Himmler's view of racialism and destiny was there any room for people like Ernst Röhm and other non-producers of new Aryans. Anyway, continuing with the Pink Triangle, Röhm had made it easy for Hitler to act against him by so flagrantly flaunting his homosexuality. His unapologetic behavior had provided a convenient peg on which Hitler could hang a multitude of sins, but Röhm's sexual habits were a sideshow. They were never the real cause of his downfall. To be sure, in addition to the charge of treason, the homosexuality of some of the victims of the purge was offered as a justification for their deaths. Homosexuality within the SA was used by Hitler as a ploy so that he could pose as the moral leader of the Nazi Party and the Reich. After the purge, Hitler had a directive ready. Quote, "I expect all SA leaders to help to preserve and strengthen the SA in its capacity as a pure and cleanly institution. In particular, I should like every mother to be able to allow her son to join the SA, the Nazi Party, and Hitler Youth without fear that he may become morally corrupted in their ranks." I hope you folks will reflect on the irony of that. "I therefore require all SA commanders to take the utmost pains to ensure that offenses under paragraph 175 are met by immediate expulsion of the culprit from the SA and the party. I want to see men as SA commanders, not ludicrous monkeys." But it was difficult to make Röhm appear as a ludicrous monkey. It was easier to make him disappear. Thus, on July 12th, Röhm's name was ordered removed from those, quote, "swords of honor" that worthy SA men had been awarded as badges of merit. The name of the Röhm House was changed. All photographs of Röhm in party offices were removed and destroyed. By the way, this is after the Night of the Long Knives. Neither Röhm nor his SA had ever harbored any actual plot to upstage Hitler and the army. And it was Goebbels who had suggested that Röhm had schemed to infiltrate the networks of power with his homosexual cronies. Röhm was innocent of such charges. He was a master at street fighting, but a novice at political intrigue. The tactics of stealth were simply beyond Röhm's skills. Nevertheless, Röhm had provided as easy a target for his enemies as had Magnus Hirschfeld. He had no respect for his superiors, he was blunt and tactless when voicing his opinions, and he rarely bothered to hide his interest in muscular young men. He was the most visible homosexual in German politics. He was a Nazi, and he was doomed.
Continuing. For most observers at the time, the elimination of Röhm and his SA was regarded either as an inter-party squabble, as an honest attempt by the Führer to create a morally respectable society, or as a symptom of the Nazi regime's internal weakness. Some thought that the Röhm affair meant that the Nazi Party was so riven by unrest and factionalism that it would not survive much longer. Only much later did the world realize that the true significance of the purge was the legalization of crime in the name of the state. Take that sentence again. Only much later did the world realize that the true significance of the purge was the legalization of crime in the name of the state. As Karl Dietrich Bracher, one of the best-informed historians of the period, has written, quote, "The arbitrary power of the Führer was formally turned into a principle. Murder, officially sanctioned and lauded, became the norm for the smooth future annihilation of political enemies, Jews, and inferiors," unquote. Barely 2 weeks after the purge, Hitler, addressing the Reichstag, declared, quote, "If anyone reproaches me and asks why I did not resort to the regular courts of justice, then all I can say is this. In this hour, I was responsible for the fate of the German people. I became the supreme judge of the German nation. Everyone must know for all future time that if he raises his hand to strike the state, then certain death is his lot." Unquote. In a single blow, by eliminating Röhm and the SA, Hitler had resolved the old conflict between political and paramilitary leadership, removed a potential and embarrassing rival, gained the support of the generals, freed Himmler and the SS from their subordinate role, and bolstered his own image as a tough leader capable of imposing discipline and high moral standards on his own party. But the real meaning of the Röhm affair escaped even seasoned observers, namely, that under Hitler, wholesale murder had become a permissible principle of state. This principle, embodied in the Rome Purge, was to have enormous and hideous implications for contragenics of all types. Jews, leftists, homosexuals, liberals, clergymen, and Jehovah's Witnesses. And again, the point can't be made too forcefully here, that what we're looking at is a major trend in the Third Reich and something which has unnerving echoes today. The use of political assassination, or the disguising of political assassination as anti-vice action. And as we think of, say, Chappaquiddick, which appears to be, we can't even get the time to go into the details, was basically a setup. As we observe Gary Hart and Donna Rice, as we observe the current infighting among the TV evangelists, with Jimmy Swaggart, Jim Baker, and so forth, getting trapped in the old sackaroo, keep this in mind.
Indeed. Continuing with the Pink Triangle, now we're going to look a little bit here at the man we were referring to a few moments ago, one Heinrich Himmler, the mastermind of the SS and also the mastermind of the Final Solution. Well, if not the mastermind, I mean, Hitler himself has had predicted that since back in his Mein Kampf days, but in terms of the implementation of the Final Solution. Reading again from the Pink Triangle and speaking of Heinrich Himmler, his image was that of a monster, devoid of any shred of humanity. He did little to dispel that impression. In October 1943, for example, he told SS leaders assembled in Poznan, Poland, quote, "What happens to the Russians, what happens to the Czechs, is a matter of utter indifference to me. Whether the other peoples live in comfort or perish interests me only insofar as we need them as slaves for our culture. Apart from that, it does not interest me. Whether or not 10,000 Russian women collapse from exhaustion while digging a tank ditch interests me only insofar as the tank ditch is completed for Germany. Most of you know what it means to see 100 corpses lying together, 500 or 1,000. To have gone through this and yet, apart from a few exceptions, examples of human weakness, to have remained decent, this has made us hard. This is a glorious page in our history that has never been written." It was also at this conference that Himmler, quote, "specifically made the connection between the Rome Purge and the policy of annihilation and confirmed the continuity of crime as a maxim of the regime." Again, let me skip back a little bit into Himmler's statement to his SS leaders, where he says, "Most of you know what it means to see 100 corpses lying together, 500 or 1,000, to have gone through this and yet remain decent. This has made us hard. This is a glorious page in our history that has never been written." In other words, the fact of being able to slaughter thousands of people is in the SS mode, that is what was one of the glories, and as far as they were concerned, one of the unwritten glories of the SS, was their ability to do this for the fatherland. And as mentioned, Himmler specifically makes the connection between the Rome Purge and the policy of annihilation. And as said before, the very idea that that not only are people enemies of the state, not only should they be incapacitated, but in fact that it is legitimate to engage in wholesale murder for the good of the state.
Yeah, again, the last part of the sentence, Himmler in this speech confirms the continuity of crime as a maxim of the regime. That's very important. And again, bearing in mind the cloaking of the Rome Purge, which was actually a rivalry between Rome and the regular army people, as anti-homosexual or anti-vice action, became one of the types of crimes which became a maxim of this regime. We're going to look now at how Hitler, including the aforementioned General von Fritsch, how Hitler eliminated those members of the German General Staff who disagreed with his plans for the war. A point should be made here, although Hitler and the Nazi Party was itself a child of the German General Staff, specifically the political department of the Reichswehr under General von Lassow, there were many, many rivalries within it, and in particular, a lot of generals who initially supported Hitler because they saw Hitler correctly as the returning of militarism and conquest to Germany, they in fact disagreed with him over tactics. General Ludwig von Beck, who was chairman of their, was chief of the German General Staff for a long time, was one of the earliest and most ardent supporters of Hitler. In fact, at the Ulm trials, he specifically became the first German army officer to defend Nazi party membership among his enlisted men. He later became an opponent of Hitler's simply because he disagreed with Hitler's plans for totaler Krieg. He favored the Bismarckian principle of a limited war involving alliances with other nations. So, because often Ludwig Beck, who was basically a diehard Prussian militarist and initially an enthusiastic Nazi, or Nazi supporter, has often been cited as a leader of the German resistance, and that is something of a fallacy under the circumstances. We're going to take a look now, though, at how Hitler used not only charges of immorality, but charges of homosexuality to eliminate his political rivals. Continuing with the Pink Triangle. The following discussion of the cashiering of Werner von Blaumberg, First Minister of Defense, later General Marshal of the Armed Forces, and of Baron Werner von Fritsch, Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces, is perhaps tangential to a chronicle of homosexuals under the Third Reich. Nevertheless, if I am reluctant to consign it to a footnote, it is because such a discussion demonstrates Hitler's use of charges of sexual misconduct, some possibly factual, others clearly spurious, to force the resignations of men like von Blaumberg and von Fritsch, who had become difficult and obstinate, and because the trial of von Fritsch irreparably undermined the independence of the military commanders who, until 1938, had successfully resisted the encroachments of the SS and Gestapo. The 1938 trial of von Fritsch on charges of homosexual indecencies was based on documents collected by Goering, Himmler, and Heydrich.
Continuing. That Hitler himself joined the team is due to the events of the Hussbach conference of November 1937.
By the way, those are the team that were opposed to von Blaumberg and von Fritsch and von Blaumberg.
Hitler had gathered the heads of all the armed services and lectured them for several hours on his plan for the conquest of Europe. Von Fritsch protested that the army was in no way ready. Von Blaumberg vacillated, but finally overcame his scruples and started preparing for Operation Green, the code name of the campaign against Czechoslovakia. During the conference, the usually cool von Fritsch lost his temper and argued energetically against Goering. It did not endear him to Goering. The unimaginative timidity of his generals convinced Hitler that he had to dismantle the army high command. He had to get rid of von Blaumberg, von Fritsch, and other traditionalists. Goering, too, realized that with the exception of the upper echelons of the Catholic Church, the armed forces were the only source of institutional power the Nazis had not yet subdued. Goering also hoped to be appointed successor to either von Fritsch or von Blaumberg. He fanned the fires against von Blaumberg, and luck was on his side. Von Blaumberg had married a girl, quote, with a past. Von Blaumberg, a widower in his 60s with two grown children, had met a woman named Eva Grün, whose mother had once run a massage parlor. Though Goering had discovered that Eva had once posed for several nude photos, some of which bordered on the pornographic, he did not immediately inform von Blaumberg. Von Blaumberg married Eva in a simple ceremony. The witnesses were Goering and Hitler. Shortly afterward, Goering showed von Blaumberg the police blotter containing the photos of his new wife. To avoid public disgrace, von Blaumberg, broken and humiliated, tendered his resignation and took Eva on a honeymoon to Italy. Hitler did not hand over von Blaumberg's job to Goering, but instead appointed himself chief of the supreme command of the army, a post he invented.
Continuing. Now, the more resilient von Fritsch had to be tackled. Baron Werner von Fritsch, at first glance, conveys the image of the exemplary Prussian officer, complete with clipped speech and monocle. In fact, this brilliant military tactician was a shy, deeply religious introvert. He had a pronounced sense of justice, and frequently interfered to soften the punishment of soldiers caught violating minor army regulations. His sense of personal responsibility, his total devotion to the army, won him the admiration of officers and enlisted men alike. He had only one hobby. He loved to ride horses whenever his duties permitted it. He had never married, and had few known relationships with women. Such conduct was not viewed with suspicion. It corresponded to a tradition of the Prussian army, some of whose most brilliant generals had been lifelong bachelors. Von Fritsch was also immune to the charm the Führer occasionally lavished on those he needed, and tended to stay aloof from the new Nazi court. Solitary, straightforward, and pious, he was no match for the plots of his adversaries. Although he never trusted the Nazi leaders, He only caught on to the true character of Hitler and his aides when it was too late. Even while the von Blomberg crisis took its course, the Göring Himmler-Heydrich machine was searching for material to incriminate von Fritsch. It is not certain who first unearthed a dossier containing information dating back to 1933. It recorded the confessions of Otto Schmidt, a 29-year-old thief with a long record of fraud and blackmail. Captain Meisinger, the newly appointed head of the Gestapo's security office for combating abortion and homosexuality, listened with interest as Schmidt claimed that in the winter of 1933, he had seen an elderly gentleman in a brown coat with a fur collar carrying a cane picking up a well-known hustler. The two men had disappeared into a dark alley where Schmidt said he saw them commit homosexual acts. After the two separated, Schmidt followed the gentleman and began to blackmail him. Schmidt could not seize much money out of his prey. The gentleman soon collapsed and hired a nurse who guarded him faithfully. Schmidt swore that the man he had blackmailed was General Werner von Fritsch. Whether Meisinger knew from the start that the gentleman Schmidt allegedly had watched was actually Captain Achim von Fritsch, an ailing retiree, remains open to speculation. Probably, he found out after a few weeks of inquiry. Still, during an interrogation in 1936, when he showed Schmidt some photos of General Werner von Fritsch, Schmidt assured him that this was the man he had blackmailed. Meisinger was delighted. He notified Himmler and Heydrich.
Continuing. In January 1938, von Fritsch was summoned to speak to Hitler. He not only found himself facing the Führer, but also Göring and Schmidt, the blackmailer, who called out, "That's him." Von Fritsch said only, "I don't know this person." His denial was not enough. Von Fritsch's first trial took place in March 1938, but was aborted just as the blackmailer began to be cross-examined. Hitler had decided to march into Austria. When the trial resumed a few weeks later, von Fritsch's counsel had prepared several traps for Schmidt. The Gestapo was also unable to browbeat the hustler into identifying von Fritsch. Finally, old Captain Achim von Fritsch, although obviously beaten in prison, admitted everything. The court acquitted von Fritsch of all charges. It did not matter. The armed forces had suffered a devastating blow to its morale from which it was never to recover. Now that von Fritsch was rehabilitated, Hitler mailed him a letter that is a masterpiece of double talk. Hitler observed that he, like the general, had suffered much slander. Hitler promised to make public the general's vindication before the German people. He never did. Instead, he appointed von Fritsch to the colonelcy of his old regiment, a meaningless gesture. Von Fritsch was killed during the war in Poland in September of 1939.
So again, what we're looking at here, and this stems from the Rome Purge, we're looking at not only the continuity of crime as a maxim of the state, but specifically in the context of the present discussion, the use of, quote, anti-vice action as a pretext for political assassination. And again, as you watch the Democratic front runners going down because they make the mistake of hopping into the sack with the wrong woman, as you watch Pat Robertson make his charges that, in fact, Jimmy Swaggart's recent escapade or apparent escapade with a prostitute was, in fact, an attempt by George Bush to discredit him by extension. As you observe yearly, every 4 years, everybody lamenting the fact that the albatross of Chappaquiddick prevents Ted Kennedy from running for the Democrats, bear all of this in mind. One of the things we talk about, for those of you who eventually hear this program on tape, one of the things we talk about on our regular show are the four B's of American politics: bullets, bribes, bids, and blackmail. And with the profound influence of the Third Reich national security establishment on our own, I don't think it should become as all that much of a surprise.
And what also shouldn't come as a surprise to you is that we're overdue for a break, and we're going to take one. In fact, what we are talking about, for those of you who, shame on you, just tuned in for some reason, we are tonight detailing, using largely the Richard Plant book, The Pink Triangle, the short-lived rise and the catastrophic fall of the of homosexual political power in Germany during the Weimar Republic. And mostly, of course, what we're also doing is drawing parallels to the various exploitations of the homosexual panic, the AIDS crisis, the pornography panic, the child molestation panic by the forces of reaction in our own country.
And the anti-abortion movement, which is something we're going to be touching on in a minute.
Yes, indeed, yes. And we've been talking most recently about Heinrich Himmler, that distinguished chicken farmer and mass murderer, head of the SS, and his strange theories of eugenics and his hatred of anything that diminished the true and proper breeding of the German master race. And I'm reminded, and I've been sitting here for the last 10 minutes or so trying to remember the name of the guy, Paul somebody or other, who a Reagan administration, he's not in the Reagan administration, but he does a lot of stuff for them, who just published his thing recently, wound up front page news about a month and a half ago, about the fact that we Americans need to breed.
I was thinking about that. I was thinking Wattenberg, but that's not.
Yes, that is it. It's Ben Wattenberg.
Ben Wattenberg.
Absolutely.
I was thinking that. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Ben Wattenberg, who is a conservative thinker, much enjoyed by the Reagan administration and their ilk. And Mr. Wattenberg just recently published a screed that made the front pages of most newspapers about the fact that that Americans need to breed, that we're being overrun by, he didn't say it, but the implication was by the swarthy and treacherous races of the world. And
beyond that is something which is we're going to see echoes to a T, what Himmler had to say, basically that we wouldn't have enough good American blood to fight a future war. Specifically,
right.
He talked about the Soviet Union and how they were outbreeding us, and that was a major, major focus of Third Reich psychosexual attitude, basically, as we're going to see. In fact, what better introduction to the book than what you just gave there, Sir Tuck? Anyway, returning to The Pink Triangle by Richard Plant. We're now going to talk about, again, the Nazi attitudes towards sexuality, towards reproduction. Their attitudes towards homosexuality should be seen in this context, although we're going to branch out for the time being a little bit from the subject of homosexuality in Nazi Germany per se, or their attitudes towards it. Returning to the Pink Triangle. An important key to his cockeyed sexual cosmology is the speech Himmler delivered on February 18, 1937 in Bad Tölz, the site of his elite SS training academy. Germany, Himmler declared, needed a national sexual budget, unquote, to make up for the loss of more than 1 million of its soldiers killed in World War I. Germany had suffered the sharpest decline in its birth rate of all European nations, reaching an exceptional low in 1933. To be sure, the battered economy probably had been the chief cause, but there were other, less obvious and more insidious reasons for Germany's weakened condition. Corruption by the Weimar Republic, for instance. Venereal diseases had spread throughout the country, especially among younger people, precisely those who could produce children. In addition, the Republic had been beset by another illness, according to statistics. There were 2 million homosexuals. Himmler made a quick calculation. 2 million men killed in the last war, plus 2 million homosexuals, equaled 4 million German women without husbands. That, he concluded, was a catastrophe for Germany. It was even worse than the 500,000 babies he estimated to have been lost through abortion. Homosexuals, Himmler emphasized, corrupted other men, making them unwilling or unable to beget children. If this vice continues, he warned, it will be the end of Germany.
Continuing, a, quote, good race producing few children was destined to be extinct in 200 years, while, quote, nations with many children can gain supremacy and mastery of the world, unquote. Sex, therefore, was a matter of public concern, not a private affair. Ancient Germany, which always had, quote, masculine dominance, knew this. Germany's Teutonic forebears, quote, knew what to do with homosexuals. They drowned them in bogs. No, it should not be called punishment. It was, quote, extermination of abnormal existence. Unfortunately, the new Germany could not apply the same technique. He did not say whether this was due to a scarcity of suitable bogs, but he would see to it that, quote, like stinging nettles, we will rip them out, meaning the homosexuals, throw them on a heap and burn them. Otherwise, if we continue to have this vice predominant in Germany, without being able to fight it, we'll see the end of Germany, the end of the Germanic world, unquote. Excuse me. Further, quote, all homosexuals are cowards. They lie, just like Jesuits. Homosexuality leads to a state of mind that doesn't know what it does, unquote. In other words, homosexuals are soft and effeminate. They are not really men. They do not fight. Homosexuality is a crime against nature and must be stamped out. The Weimar Republic was guilty of criminal laxness. During a six-week period in 1934, the Berlin police and the SS arrested more homosexuals than the Weimar police did in 15 years. Himmler proposed that any SS man caught in unnatural carnal acts with another man should be publicly disgraced, expelled from the order, put into a camp, and, quote, shot while trying to escape, unquote. but he only issued the pertinent Führer's decree relating to purity in the SS and police 4 years later, in 1941, when the campaign against homosexuals had already been eclipsed by the effort to destroy Europe's Jews. A former Puritan, who had once advised chastity before marriage, Himmler now declared prostitutes to be necessary to prevent young men from having to, quote, turn to homosexuals for gratification, since there were often no suitable young women of, quote, good blood available for marriage. Himmler was not sure what was worse, a young, healthy German male seeking sexual release by turning to a woman of impure race or giving himself to a homosexual. He then sounded the two notes of what was to be a recurring rhapsody. 1. In the old days, before industrialization, everything was much better. 2. Degeneracy is not practiced by the peasantry. Blood laws were strictly enforced in the villages. Even illegitimate children were accepted. Himmler strove to persuade German women that it should be a point of pride to give birth to illegitimate children, that it honored the Führer and the state, that it was old-fashioned to worry about a marriage certificate. He had founded his Springs of Life hostels, providing homes for unmarried mothers and their offspring, to carry this through. Now, one of the things that's really, I think it says a great deal, and certainly that many other wiser people before myself have made the connection between sexual repression and violence and twisted sexual imagery and violence. It's not insignificant at all when you're talking about the larger picture of the Nazi philosophy to talk about the sexual picture. For one thing, as Plant mentions in his book, and as other people have noted, the sexual imagery in a lot of the speech making of the Nazis was quite obvious. Hitler used to refer to the civilization of Europe or of Germany by the Jews, in other words, likening the Jews to a venereal disease. Himmler himself was basically what you have to call a psychotic on the subject. Not that he wasn't a psychotic by any other normal means, but this was a particular bugbear of his that he went on and on about, and The whole idea of sexuality became so distorted into these twin drives of one of just violence, of violence and conquest, and on the other hand, of purity of race. And this is what Himmler is trying to straddle in this situation, and it causes a rhetoric that goes outside even the normal bounds of Looney Tunes rhetoric from the Nazis.
Now, one of the things to consider here, not only obviously that passage that we just read you, reveals why, from a strategic concept, the Nazis were opposed to homosexuality, at least to hear them say it. In addition to that, it's very interesting that illegitimate children were actually encouraged to increase the rich stock of pure German blood. Another parallel, and perhaps this will also seem a bit forced to some listeners, but you consider today the anti-abortion movement, and in particular Jerry Falwell, who is establishing centers for unwed mothers to have their children so that the children can be raised as good Christians. Again, this, at least in certain respects, echoes directly the Nazi attitudes towards reproductive rights. Another passage here which reflects that, and then perhaps ruminate again for a second. Although this 1937 speech, that's the speech we just read, was the most extensive account of Himmler's ideas about homosexuals, he addressed the issue in several other speeches and memoranda. For example, in 1939, before SS leaders in Hamburg, he ranked homosexuality as one of the four illnesses, along with the flight from countryside to cities, suicide, and the decline of the birth rate, whose symptoms must be diagnosed so that the patient, Germany, could be cured. It was unpatriotic to limit the family to two children, especially if the parents were well-to-do. Abortion must be discouraged. It kills living beings and makes many women sterile. All women must cultivate joy in begetting, unquote, and barren women must accept the fact that they need children. Spring of Life hostels would provide these barren women with suitable quarters and conception partners. Quote, what we need is a new respect for the illegitimate mother who has the courage to play her natural part. That last sentence again, because you will see this echoed almost to the word by some of the more fanatical anti-choice people. What we need is a new respect for the illegitimate mother who has the courage to play her natural part. Many of the more fanatical evangelists are saying just that, that they should be washed of their sins so that they can go ahead and have the kid and so forth.
Again, too, it's extremely... it's frightening how many parallels there are. As Dave just mentioned, the anti-abortion movement, and again the emphasis, and it, again it's rather startling too, as often I'm sure many of you out there have sort of chuckled in a sick way over the fact that it's the people who rant the loudest about these things who are in fact themselves quite often the most viciously depraved by what most of us would call real moral standards. I thought that it was particularly, again, entertaining in a really twisted way. Hitler's citation after the Night of the Long Knives that homosexuality in the SA had to be stamped out because German mothers had to know that any of their sons who joined the SS or the SA could do so without having to worry about their moral values being impaired. Of course, these moral values don't extend to preventing people from lining up thousands of Jews in a ditch and machine gunning them or running them off to gas chambers, but God forbid that they should have sexual relationship with a man.
Now, the next two passages we're going to look at reflect a frequent theme in Nazi sexual propaganda, namely that homosexuality was literally a disease, an epidemic, a communicable epidemic. One of the things that they stressed constantly is that homosexuals should be purged from society so that they can't infect others with their habits. Then, as seen in the passages we just read, Germany won't have babies, etc., etc. But homosexuality was viewed as a communicable disease by the Nazis, and obviously we see certain unnerving echoes of this in AIDS. Perhaps this provided the impetus for those who created it.
Again, a short segment from the Pink Triangle. As Reichsfuhrer SS, Himmler considered homosexuals, quote, as useless as hens which don't lay eggs. They were, quote, sociosexual propagation misfits, unquote. Homosexuality was to be diagnosed as a contagious disease. The plague was highly dangerous because it affected the young, precisely the group destined to bring future soldiers into the world. Again, you might even, if you want to explore it a little deeply, essentially what the Himmler program was is that Germany under the Nazis was to be essentially a cancer. It was to keep breeding forever, larger and larger, until it pushed out all other organisms, and homosexuals were therefore impeding. They were cells that would not reproduce, which again not only gives you a key to Himmler's sexual ideas, but gives you a key to the general Nazi philosophy about the value of human beings. They are valuable only insofar as they can be used to kill other human beings.
Once again, and this again, we're only citing two passages here, but it's a frequent theme of Nazi sexual propaganda. Now, the Schirach here, referred to as Walter von Schirach, one of the many leaders of the Hitler Youth. In 1941, by the way, Schirach, S-C-H-I-R-A-C-H. In 1941, Schirach's office issued a manual on the behavior of the young, part statistics, part indoctrinational tract, part prescription for action against violators of the sexual and behavioral code of the Hitler Youth. The need to do so suggests that not all members of the Hitler Youth were always able to conform to the code of Nordic purity and righteousness. It was entitled Criminality and Delinquency of Youth. Once again, homosexuality was defined as a dangerous, contagious epidemic. The Weimar Republic was accused of standing by, quote, while this epidemic spread everywhere, and even criminal statistics did not bother with registering it, unquote. One page illustrates the snowball effect with graphics. A photo of one, quote, main seducer, unquote, named Hasso Engel, E-N-G-E-L, is placed in the middle of a chart. Grouped around him are the genealogies of those whom he had seduced, those whom the seduced subsequently had seduced, and so on. Hasso was precocious. He admitted having started his activities at age 8, quote, a warning example of a hereditarily unsound delinquent who had helped spread this epidemic and must be viewed as a contamination risk. Now, one of the points to make here, too, is, again, not only do we see homosexuality once again portrayed as an epidemic, but the interesting thing one of the things that struck me, and again, perhaps some listeners will think we're forcing parallels here, was the charting out of the sexual escapades of Hasso Engel. One of the things that we've talked about during the regular talk show we've had here is a recent book called The Band Played On by, now I've forgotten the guy's name.
Randy Schultz.
Randy Schultz from the San Francisco Chronicle. One of the major points of his book, one of the major features in something which we have lambasted rather heavily, is his portrayal of the so-called Patient Zero, I believe it was Canadian Airlines steward of, or flight attendant of Swedish birth, or maybe it's the other way around, Swedish Airlines of Canadian birth, named Gaetan Dugas, D-U-G-A-S, who, at least according to Randy Schultz and the Center for Disease Control, was the person who brought AIDS to the United States. And in illustrating this, they charted out all the people he was with, all the people he was with were with, and so forth. And again, it is reminiscent of Hasso Engel. And one of the, well, a couple of the thoughts that occur to us were those statistics come to us courtesy of the Center for Disease Control. As Nip Tuck indicated, the Center for Disease Control is actually an extension of the military. Interestingly enough, currently a branch of the Navy, right?
Yes, because of Coop, who I believe is, Coop is in fact a Navy, holds a Navy rank. It's hard to remember. No, maybe they're the Army right now. I can't remember.
Well, the interesting thing is that before joining the AIDS Commission, Admiral Watkins was Chief of Naval Operations, which is why I wondered about that.
Yeah, no, it is interesting. And it's one of those things that seesaws back and forth, like the person who carries the football and stuff like that, depending on the preferences, I think, of the chief executive.